It may be hard to believe, but in the year 2021, school segregation is still prevalent across the nation. It just looks a little different than it did back in the 1900s. And in some places, it's getting worse. Today on the show, we'll be discussing a Supreme Court case that was decided 20 years after Brown v. Board of Education. It's not as well known, but it was instrumental in creating the segregated districts we see today. We'll also talk about the ways that school segregation and school funding are intrinsically connected. I'm Isaac Goff Mitchell, and you're listening to The Youth Vote. This is episode 2 in our Education in America series. Stay with us. In 2014, an organization called EdBuild formed with the goal of identifying and addressing inequality in school funding. EdBuild closed its doors last summer, which was the original plan. EdBuild actually stopped its operations because it had finished the job it set out to do, which was to research education inequality. And in just 6 years, the group discovered some very alarming trends. For example, EdBuild found that the majority of public school students in the United States attend racially concentrated schools. This means 26% of students attend schools with predominantly white children, and 27% of students attend schools with predominantly children of color. The most bleak trend revealed by EdBuild is that these white school districts receive $23 billion more than non-white districts, even though they serve the same amount of students. To understand why non-white schools received so much less money than white schools, we talked with Sahava Stadler. She used to work with EdBuild and helped to compile a lot of the data for the group's reports. She now works for Education Trust as the Special Assistant for State Funding and Policy. Sahava explained that schools receive money from three different revenue streams: at the federal, the state, and the local level. And when comparing the three, the federal government actually provides the least amount of funding.
So I think people think that there's a whole lot of money that Congress authorizes every year for education. And yeah, it's some big numbers, but it's going out to like 13,000 school districts nationally. And when you figure it out, the federal government provides 8-ish% of public school dollars. That's all.
Schools get most of their money from state and local sources.
The rest is split into two 45-46% buckets, some from the state level and some from the local level. So every school district on average is going to have a little less than half from the state, a little less than half from taxes collected in their local school district.
Notice how Sahava mentioned taxes collected at the local level. This is where the biggest funding disparities show up, since most of the money at the local level is collected from property taxes. I asked Sahava how big of a role community wealth plays in school funding.
The answer is a problematically huge role, and so here's why. First of all, let's just sort of get the basic concept out of the way. So a property tax is a percentage. So if your house is worth $1 million and my house is worth $70,000, then a 1% property tax on your $1 million house is going to raise a lot more money than a 1% property tax on my $70,000 house. Add that up. If every house in your school district is worth $1 million and every house in my school district is worth $70,000, well, then at the end of the day, your property tax pot is just going to be a lot bigger than mine.
But remember, this local funding is only about half the amount of the money that schools get. They also get a huge portion from the state, and every state has its own school funding formula. Sahava said states try to make up for these disparities when they decide how much money each district gets.
They try and take into account those differences in wealth when they figure out how much money they're going to give to districts. So in most places, the state will give more help, more state aid, to the places that have a harder time raising local money. And that's great. But it's not enough because the disparities on the ground are so huge that states just can't outrun that problem. You could have school districts next door to each other, literally next door to each other, with disparities of like $20,000 per kid, $30,000 per kid. It depends on the state, and we're talking very different numbers in different parts of the country, but states just don't have the money to outrun that kind of gap.
Since school districts get money based on the wealth of the families who live there, I wanted to know, why is it that some districts have such high concentration of wealthy families and why others have a high concentration of low-income families? To understand this modern segregation, we need to get into a little bit of history again. After Brown versus Board of Education, schools were told they had to integrate, and because of racism, many of them just didn't want to do that. We talked about this more in our last episode, so if you haven't yet, you should definitely go back and listen to it. But basically, while some districts were making progress with integration, there were many people working behind the scenes to keep white students separate from everyone else. And in 1974, this all culminated into a Supreme Court ruling called Milliken v. Bradley. The Milliken case focused on the Detroit Public School District, which at the time was severely segregated. Two-thirds of the students were black, while the growing suburbs were almost completely made up of white students. This school segregation in the 60s and 70s was not at all unique to Detroit. One of the biggest contributors to this divide was racist housing policies and practices. We could spend an entire episode talking about the various racist policies that plagued communities at this time. And if you want to learn more about this, I recommend you check out The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein. For the purposes of this conversation, we'll try to simplify the issue. A big piece of this puzzle was a practice called redlining, which began back in the 1930s. The Homeowners Loan Corporation created maps that gave different neighborhoods a grade based on their creditworthiness. If a neighborhood received a high enough grade, people in that neighborhood would qualify for better mortgage loans. If a neighborhood received a low enough grade, people in that neighborhood might not even qualify for any loans at all. These grades were racist, and any neighborhood that consisted of mostly black families or other people of color generally received an F. Redlining, along with other racist housing practices, were prevalent across the country and lasted for decades. They created racially segregated neighborhoods and prevented minority neighborhoods from accumulating wealth. If these practices created these segregated districts in the past, then it's no surprise that districts are still segregated today. Here's Zahava again.
If the value of your district's education, if the money in the budget for you as a kid in a classroom has something to do with the value of your parents' house, right? For some bizarro reason, right? We've set it up this way. If there's going to be a connection, well, then it really matters where your parents, and more than that, where their parents and their parents were able to buy a house. How much were they able to sell it for? How much wealth have they been able to build in their home? Over generations, white Americans have had the opportunity, with government help, to build wealth in their homes, to build up property wealth. And so it is not at all surprising that when you draw a school district border around a predominantly black community, after generations of systematic government policies that have disadvantaged black families in the area of home buying, in the area of building wealth in their home, in their property, that what you wind up with is less money in their property in those school districts, and therefore less money for schools. And so EdBuild, where I used to work, did a study to compare the dollars available to predominantly white and predominantly non-white school districts. About half of kids are in a school district that's very heavily one or the other, predominantly white or predominantly non-white, as opposed to a nice diverse mix. And so if you look at the district serving that half of kids, even though those groups are about the same size, like there are about as many kids in predominantly white districts as there are in predominantly non-white districts, the predominantly white districts have a collective $23 billion advantage. Same number of kids, but because they're in districts where the lines are drawn differently around different levels of property wealth, there's a huge, huge school funding disadvantage experienced by communities of color.
We'll talk more after this short break. Stay with us.
Hi, my name is Lily Mott, and I'm the host of a podcast called Be the Change, on which I feature young people and organizations who are making a difference around the world. I started the podcast to share my own story of being tear gassed and removed from Lafayette Square while protesting in D.C. following the death of George Floyd. Since then, I've interviewed some amazing people who are doing great work around the country, and I would love for you to check out my show. Again, it's called Be the Change, and you can listen to it now wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, everyone. I want to do a quick recap here. Just over half the school districts in America today are deeply segregated. They might not explicitly say students of a certain race cannot attend, but the reality is these districts either have mostly white students or mostly students of color. And the funding gap between these distinct groups is gigantic. $23 billion collectively. But how do the dollar amounts actually impact students in the classroom? A growing body of research shows that increased school funding can lead to increases in graduation rates, higher wages, and an overall reduction in adult poverty, especially for students from low-income families. I spoke recently with Representative Jessica Miranda. She is a former school board president and currently serves as an Ohio State representative. She gave insight into the ways funding cuts can hit districts.
So the kind of practical real-world problems that happen from being underfunded in your school system and not being able to pass local levies, right? That means you have to go back to the drawing board of the school's entire budget and you have to start cutting things. And that stems anywhere from cutting teachers, vital personnel and staff, to cutting programs. You know, you hear the stories all over the country, and I know across the state, of cutting the arts program, right? Or cutting the extracurricular activities like sports and band and music and, you know, all of those things that go into what we know kids need as a well-rounded education. It's just a crazy, never-ending system of, well, we're not getting what we need from the state budget. If we don't get what we need, therefore, from your local community and continually keep failing at passing these levies, because people are taxed out, right? Let me just remind folks who are listening that, you know, there are many people in our communities who just don't want to support schools, period, and don't want to vote on school issues because of, you know, however they feel about public education or the school district as a whole, et cetera. But the main reason why lots of people can't support these local levies is because they're just taxed out, right? They are at the brim of what they can afford for their bottom line. And I understand that. It is a broken system. It needs to be fixed. And when we don't achieve raising the kind of funds we need and the kind of resources we need, right, to fund a well-rounded education, then we have to start cutting things. And if school districts have to start cutting things, guess what else they can cut? School resource officers, security personnel. You know, that those are real world issues, real life, everyday practical decisions school boards, superintendents, and treasurers have to make if they can't fill the gaps that the state is not fulfilling in school funding.
Just to kind of like summarize what you just said, would it be fair to say that due to the funding system in place, schools are less safe, people could lose their jobs, and kids could have a lower quality of education?
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there. That's the reality.
Representative Miranda is currently working on legislation to address school funding disparities within the state of Ohio. I wanted to get a better idea of the ways teachers are impacted by funding and other resource cuts. So I went ahead and spoke with a teacher named Brittany Garcia Espinosa about her experiences as a teacher in the Kansas City, Kansas public school district.
So I teach in a large urban school district in Kansas City, Kansas. I would definitely just say the experiences that the families have with education can be very different than what you would experience in a suburban area, where parents in those areas may have very positive encounters. Some of our parents don't, or they weren't able to experience our education to the fullness that they would have liked to due to life circumstances, inability to afford tuition. They weren't encouraged to go to college, and so they never thought of it as an option for themselves. A lot of our students are first generation born here. So their parents come from Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico, where schools can be out for months at a time, and they didn't have constant access to education. The parents understand what it's like to live without constant access to education, and they want better for their kids. The Hispanic population, they're definitely driven. They want the best.
Kansas City, Kansas Public Schools is a majority minority district. About 50% of the students are Hispanic, 27% are Black, 7% are Asian, and just over 10% are white. Ed Build's research found that in Kansas, schools like this, with a majority minority student body, receive about $1,700 less per student on average. Teaching in low-income districts can contribute to teacher stress. Research from the Learning Policy Institute concludes that more funding often means schools can have smaller class sizes, and that they can pay teachers more, which attracts both more qualified and more experienced teachers. Brittany said she has watched this play out in her own district.
I would say that I have seen, this is my fifth year, but I have seen 6 new teachers in and out. They only stayed 1 year. They couldn't handle, and none of them are teaching anymore either. It affects how many teachers are cycled through that school in a school year. How many teachers are actually going to come back the following school year, because it does affect the size. It affects how many desks you have in your classroom. Are students sharing desks? Are they sharing books? Do they have enough resources to go around to support the students? Because if a teacher is feeling that stress, they're less likely to come back. And if a teacher isn't prepared to know that that's something you could encounter and how to creatively deal with those issues and just come at it with a positive mindset, that's something that you would not even consider would be an issue.
We have outlined so many problems in this episode, and we want to take a little bit of time now to talk about the ways that these issues might improve in the future. For teachers like Brittany, combating the teacher stress really started before she ever even got into the classroom. She talked about how she participated in a university program that focused specifically on teaching in urban school districts. You remember Dr. Poos from our last episode? It's actually the program that he's the director of.
So I think it depends on what your college prepares you with and helps you understand, because like my college did a really good job of preparing us of the gravity of our job, that our students will see a lot of teachers in and out. And do you want to be one of the adults that is continuing to be just a revolving door, a swinging door in and out of their life? And that was something that I decided early on that I did not want that.
Brittany shared some things her college program focused on that might not be as commonly taught in the typical university schools of education.
I think number one would be boundaries. We had to learn, you know, these are the boundaries that you have to set because this job can break your heart. We also had to learn, you know, these are not our kids. They have families. They're not lost puppies. If you want unconditional love and you're coming into this job for hugs and kisses, this is not the career path for you, that you're here to educate, to equip. Right off the bat, I knew, okay, I don't know best. They have their own parents. It's not my job, you know, to like parent them in such a way, you know, that I'm going to be the changing force in their life. I could be education-wise, but, you know, I have to take myself out of the equation to make it less about me and more about them.
When it comes to big picture solutions and getting more funding into schools, Zahava, who we spoke with earlier, said we need to change the whole system. She says there are 2 main ways we can do this.
There is a huge, huge disparity at ground level when you draw school districts very small. But you don't have to, right? School district borders, they're not like made up of rivers and mountains. This isn't a fact of nature that the school district line is where it is. These are policy constructions, and school district borders, in fact, do move all the time. Governments move them. And a systematic effort to redraw school district boundaries specifically with a mind towards making things more equal at ground level. That's something that just has not been tried, and districts absolutely could. So that's one. Two is you don't actually have to move the border to move the money. And so this is another way to think about it. Instead of funding schools with local district level property taxes, things collected basically within the tiny postage stamp of your town, you could say, okay, the local side of school funding is going to be county funding. We're going to share all of that across the county level. A county is a bigger and more diverse place. It includes wealthier and poorer areas. It includes kids from all backgrounds. Let's share the money across that larger area. Let's pool it and divide it up fairly.
We hope you're starting to see that the education system has some deep divides, and they are not new. As we discussed in our last episode, the history of American education is riddled with inequity. These issues are so important because without a quality education for everyone, we are holding our society back from a lot of potential progress. In order to push for this needed change, we must first be made aware of all of these problems. So in our next episode, we're taking a look at what is actually taught in schools. Why don't we learn about these nuanced issues in the classroom? What would happen if we learned a more accurate version of history? Thank you for listening, everybody. If you liked what you heard, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at The Youth Vote 1. The Youth Vote is hosted by me, Isaac Goff Mitchell, produced by Jamie Hobbs, and social media is managed by Bridget Junker. The music for this series is produced by Jim Young.